It's the Wiggins Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Welcome to the Wiggins Sessions. I'm Addison Wiggin. I just got off a Zoom call with Charles Hugh Smith from his home in Hawaii. Charles has written 11 books on everything from economics and finance to the Fed, healthcare, education, national debt, government policy, crony capitalism, you name it. Charles is on it. Charles writes a blog called Of Two Minds. You should check that out. We often feature his work in the Daily Reckoning as well. In today's session, we discuss the Delta variant, vaccines, masks, and the Bill of Rights. What you get when the state and the market abandon the middle class. So that's a big deal. How innovation and opportunity flourish when the right system's in place, which we don't have. And the beastly doom and gloom, your first step in escaping corrupt power nodes. If you're ready, let's jam. Hello, welcome to the Wiggins Sessions. Today I have Charles Hugh Smith, who we just discovered prior to talking. We have a couple things in common. We like flip-flops and Paris. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit, right? Welcome, Charles. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. How do you like to be addressed?
Charles is fine.
Charles. Okay. Well, we met Charles maybe, I want to say like 8 years ago, and we've been publishing some of your essays in the Daily Reckoning, which you can find online. So I just want to just acknowledge that the ideas that we talk about, I think we share in common, and that's literally the reason I want to talk to you. So we can get started. You're in Hawaii right now, and yes. I'm wondering how the Delta variant is affecting people in Hawaii. Is that a thing? Because right now they just reenacted a mask mandate here in Baltimore, where I've been holed up. So I'm just wondering, like, what's your experience?
Well, Hawaii is one of the states with a very high rate of vaccination, and most people consider it their responsibility to wear a mask. So the vast majority of people wear masks as a matter of course. And so everyone's kind of surprised that Delta's surging, you know, that we used to have less than 100 cases a day. Now it's over 600. So the governor is now acting to reduce the size of groups that are allowed to gather and so on. So clearly, Delta is not responding to vaccination rates of about 60 to 70% of the population.
All right, let's get into this, because I think that we have similar views on the world. And so what do you think about vaccinations in general? And I think that's an honest question, because there's a lot of people that are grappling with, should I do it? Am I being pressured to do it? Like, what's going to be the result? Like, there's a lot of skepticism.
Yeah. And for those of us that try to take a scientific view of it, we are grappling with the fact that we don't really have a lot of good data. In other words, these were sort of rushed through. And so the sample sizes were fairly large, but they didn't ask certain questions. Like, for instance, the protocol for testing the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, they didn't ask, can a vaccinated person be a carrier of the virus and transmit it to other people? So we're just now discovering that they can, in fact, because there's many news reports of people. In fact, the Baltimore Sun had a piece last week in which an epidemiologist said, I went to a party of 14 vaccinated people and 11 of us became ill with COVID. So clearly, this is not a sterilizing vaccine of the type like polio and measles. It's more like a flu type, you know, vaccine.
Yeah, but all right. So it's called COVID-19, meaning we know that this thing exists, right? So I've been trying to figure this out too. So we know that it exists. And every year, like, I have this debate with my wife, should we get the flu vaccine? Should we not? And every year, my arm is in pain for like 9 months. It's just not fun. But we do know how to battle the COVID virus. I'm not trying to put you on the spot because you're not a doctor, but I know that you knew, you're like thinking about the impact on the environment.
The way I would describe it is like this, and I'd be curious what you think. I think that the U.S. as a policy decision went all in on vaccines as the be-all to end-all that was going to cure the COVID pandemic and put it into history. And as a result of that policy decision, then we have done very little R&D in treatments. And so that's a hole in our whole strategy. And of course, there's a lot of questions about various other use of existing medications and so on. But the point is, we are lacking treatments, partly because we haven't put any effort and money into that. And so that's now becoming, it's now apparent that vaccines are not the end all to be all. And so we need to adjust policy and start focusing on treatments as well, I think, is what I hear, you know, your point being.
Well, I'm asking a different question though. And I want to get to the anti-vaxxer kind of point of view. Like, I want to talk to them in a way. So I want to say something like, just get the freaking vaccine. Like, what's the problem?
We have to understand a couple of things. One is that we cannot sacrifice the Bill of Rights on this issue, I think. And
this is exactly why I asked the question. So keep going.
Yeah. And so there's various approaches. Like here in Hawaii, the governor has sort of mandated that state employees either get vaccinated or they get weekly, you know, antigen tests. In other words, there is a back door, there is a way out, but, you know, it's just constant testing. And so as long as there's a back door or an alternative, then I think that's one policy solution. But we also have to recognize that these are not the end all to be all vaccines. In other words, they're not sterilizing, they're weakening rather rapidly. I mean, the latest study that just came out today in the state of Minnesota from the, you know, Mayo Clinic, they said like in June, like 0.7, less than 1% of the cases were Delta in June, 70% of the cases were Delta in July, and they've noticed a enormous degradation in the effectiveness of the mRNA vaccines in terms of preventing becoming ill. They're still very effective in preventing death and hospitalization. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. And I think if we look at the science, we can say that we'll probably have better vaccines going forward.
Right? Yeah, I feel like on the, let's call it the political front, you and I are probably pretty close on civil liberties. And I don't know, I would describe you as a libertarian with a lower L, like you're not a party member, right?
No. But and I'm also accused of being a Marxist. So there you go.
That's kind of funny also. So where do you come down on policy level mask mandates or vaccination cards or whatever? It's becoming a thing.
Yeah. Again, it's as you say, it's now so polarized, everything's politicized and the narratives are being twisted. So from one point of view, the side effects of these vaccines have been suppressed because, you know, as part of the sales pitch that they're safe and effective and so on. And then on the other side, the effects of long COVID and other things are being suppressed by other narratives, like as if this is just another flu, and it's clearly not, if you look at the long COVID statistics.
Yeah. So I'm curious, I think we're going way off script at the moment, but I'm just curious, like, this is going to be really interesting for me going forward. Like, how do those narratives, like, take their own path and then lead into policy?
I think that's a great
really
question.
Crazy thing to me.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about the larger context here, which is America seems to have lost the ability to reach a consensus on virtually anything. except printing money and giving it away. That's the only thing that we can agree on now, consensus wise. And I think that's a super dangerous trajectory. If you can't have consensus on anything, then where is that going to go that's going to be good? I don't see any good in that.
Yeah, I don't see any good either. And it makes me worried that the pandemic then becomes the impetus to print money. How do you connect those dots?
Exactly. And the question is that it raises is, was the pandemic a body blow that required the state and the Federal Reserve to go all in on various things? Or was the economy already weakening beneath the surface, but we don't want to talk about that? So that was glossed over by the status quo. And that would be my argument. And many other people have reached the same conclusion. You know, the U.S. economy was weakening fundamentally, structurally, and the pandemic was not so much a bolt from the blue that caused some kind of disaster. It was more like it just pushed something that was already crumbling, you know, over an edge.
Do you want to describe that theory that underlies what you just said?
Yeah, I'm going to probably use my own terminology here, but I know you'll understand, and I hope our viewers will too. I think they're familiar with both of our work. I think in the super large context of, like, we're looking at hundreds of years of history, you know, there's two mechanisms for distributing, you know, resources, capital, and agency. You know, agency being like opportunities and a say in the public decisions, right? And so those two things are the state, you know, the government, and the market, right? And the idea is both of those are supposed to be solutions which improve the well-being and prosperity of the general populace. And so my contention is both of those have failed, and that it's not that neither the government nor the market are no longer serving the interests of the citizenry than the common good. They're actually mostly serving the interests of the few, like an elite. And that's why the economy is weakening, is that it's created, there's a lot of policy distortions which are actually increasing instability and actually keeping the economy from adapting. And so that's creating fragility and instability, because if you lock everything down and don't allow the market and government to evolve and adapt, then you're going to end up with a brittle system that collapses.
Yeah. And so I know this is a tough question because it's the one that we try to answer. So I know that you're doing the same thing. Like, where do we go from here? There's no, like, Marx, I remember in I studied philosophy for a while, and Marx was trying to solve these kind of problems in the 1840s, right? So with the advent of social media, for example, and the distortion that's being created there, like, where do we go from here to, like, what's the objective now? We used to care about people making a living wage and being able to raise families. I mean, that seems like it's out the window at the moment.
Right. Let's bring up a couple topics that both you and I have addressed, which is what's changed in the last 40 years, right? And so you go, well, globalization is one, right? Where corporate America basically offshored a lot of its production.
Yeah, and they took the money.
Right. And exactly. If you call up a chart of corporate profits around, 2001, it was about $800 billion a year. And then, like, China joins the WTO, et cetera. And then, voila, the profits are now in excess of $2 trillion. And it was like a straight line up. And so what were the policy decisions there? And I think whether it was conscious or not, the policy was, we're going to emphasize or prioritize corporate profits above national security and above maintaining a middle class as part of that national security.
Yeah, I think that's an issue that we're dealing with right now. So I don't even know how to ask that question other than, as a middle class person, because that's what I am, I grew up that way, and I've done well for myself, and I plan to continue. Like, what do you do about it? Like, it's kind of like the war of the
elites, really.
And then, like, I have had no, literally no aspiration to become an elite. So, like, I could probably go out there and figure out how to do that, but I don't want to. I had three kids. I got a freaking new puppy. I don't want to figure everything out. I would rather just be able to be prosperous and make sure that the laws that are in place allow me to do that.
And I think that's very well said, Addison, as the way that that used to be the value system of America in the past.
Yeah, and so I call it the old right.
Yeah, and what's funny is even the old left was not that far away from that. It was sort of like, well, the means of reaching that. But well, let's look at and the thing about the Daily Reckoning is it's a data driven site, right? In other words, it's interested in charts, graphics, data, and I think that's really why I'm always happy to see my work on the Daily Reckoning is because it's let's look at some numbers. And so I'm going to just mention a couple of articles which I think are really consequential. One was a RAND study that came out last year. It was called Trends in Income 1975 to 2018. And it basically concluded that $50 trillion had been transferred from labor, you know, the middle class and the working class, to the elites that own most of the capital. So that $50 trillion is substantial. And it wasn't just by magic, like, oh, gosh, we just didn't look at it and suddenly it happened. No, it was the result of policies which favored capital and global corporations in globalization, in financialization, and in taxation. And, you know, I was just reading the biography of Truman by, I think it was done in the 90s. And back then in the 50s, he made $75,000 a year as a president, which was, you know, quite a bit of money. Well, half was paid in federal tax. And this wasn't like a theoretical tax rate. This is what you actually paid. Yeah, that was what you paid if you were well off. And so now, of course, we see that if you make $500,000 a year, you're going to be, as a professional or as an entrepreneur, you're going to be paying a lot of tax, at least 40%+, you know, state, local, federal.
I'm at like 58 right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was going to say 40 is minimum. Then it goes up from there because, though, you know, if we live in high tax states, it's 10% on top of the 34%, you know, federal, plus you got property taxes and on. But if you make $50 million, well, Addison, we know what happens then. Then you have a P.O. box in Ireland, you have, you know, tax havens, and you pay virtually nothing. And so this unfairness, I think, is part of what's eating away at America.
But is that a thing? Are you worried about that?
The unfairness or the tax rate?
Well, I mean, the tax rate is like governed, but the unfairness to the middle class. Do you worry about that? Do you care about that?
I do, because I think that humans as a social animal, there's a lot of evidence that we're extremely attuned to fairness. In other words, we're willing to join a hierarchy, but there has to be a sense of fair play and fairness, or, you know, like equality before the law is how we put it in the modern terms. And when something is rigged against us, then we eventually, you know, rebel, because that's just not the way we're wired. And so I do worry.
Yeah. All right. So I'll go along with that. But then the way that we govern the taxation rate, like, let's say we say it's unfair, is through the political system, right?
Right.
And even somebody like Warren Buffett's dad was a gold bug, right? And taught his own son about taxation and fairness and all that kind of stuff. And yet it still continues. Like, there's a legislative motive to continue unfairness, which is just seems weird to me. And I know that you thought this through a lot because I've read all your stuff, but like, where does that come from? What, we could just steal money from people and then make it lawful?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And my answer is, again, referring to other people's studies, there was a study called Testing Theories of American Politics, which came out in, I think, about 2014 or 15. And they basically looked at, does the government listen to the bottom 99.9%, or do they listen and respond to the 0.1%? And the answer was, well, as we all know, they respond in the vast majority to the 0.1%, right? Because it's all about money and lobbying and so on. So I think we've lost the ability that the common good has been lost in the shuffle. And that now what I see is wrong is that our democracy had it was designed to have corrective mechanisms, right? Like there was a judiciary that could limit excessive concentration of wealth and power, right? And the legislature was intended to do so, and the president has the veto power. Well, all of those have gone by the wayside. And so there's no corrective mechanism left.
Do you think it's failed? Like, how do you feel? Do you think like it's failed?
I think it's failed because the concentration of wealth and power has now become so excessive that they've bought their way around virtually all of it. So we have a two-tier legal system. The legislature is basically bought and owned despite its protestations. And the marketplace has also been corrupted and distorted so that, you know, most of the American economy is, you know, dominated by monopolies and cartels. And right. Those are, of course,
what happens in a system like what we have. Like, how do people survive?
Yeah, that's the problem is how do you survive when a lot of your paycheck goes to monopolies and cartels that are only interested not in the common good or increasing productivity, but just in maintaining their lock on the marketplace? And so I think to me, it's like, okay, we need to rethink or redo our working of our value system and also our politics and the marketplace so that the things that create prosperity and adaptability, which is part of prosperity, right? You've got to be able to change, grow, innovate, is the government should be focused on enforcing transparency, you know, competition and adaptability. And in fact, it's protecting all the monopolies and cartels by sort of suppressing those elements.
All right, let's try to get somewhere positive, because I agree with you on all of those points. But let's just try to say something that people can invest in. So, you know, we might decide to invest in technology, for example, because that does change the landscape. What do you think about this space race? The private space race.
Yeah. Well,
do you care about it? Because personally, I don't.
Well, I think it's interesting to differentiate two elements of that. One is the innovation, like say in SpaceX, of reusing these rocket parts, and so that if that makes it faster, better, cheaper, then that's an advance. In terms of billionaires having joyrides in space, that sort of smacks of the sort of excess of let them eat cake. So I think we have to differentiate between true innovation that's making something faster, better, cheaper, and something that just seems to be the playthings of billionaires.
All right, you just reminded me of something. So I'm going to ask you a different question. I was trying to get this film off the ground called Risk, which was about like, how do we think about innovation and when entrepreneur means the risk taker, like how do we actually do that? And I put together this kind of like short film and I showed it down in Baltimore. And there was an elderly, and I'm only saying that because he was older than me, gentleman from Mexico. And he's like, I don't understand how Americans create new things. And so that was his question. He's like, you're not answering that in the video. So like you're talking about innovation and entrepreneurship. And I think that all of that is important because that's what drives everything forward. Even if we don't know what the next turn is going to reveal. So how do you think about that? Like, what do you think? Like if I were the Mexican dude, and I asked you that question, what do you think is the answer for Americans?
Well, I think that's a terrific topic. And I love the question because that really is there's a bit of ambiguity and mystery in that. Exactly how do you create that? And of course, from, again, the big perspective, we have to say that we have an economy and a culture and a society and a government which either enables that or encourages that. Now, we want it to encourage, but at least if it enables it. And this is what's the difference between countries that are oligarchies ruled by 100 families is they tend to not have the systems in place to allow for innovation from the bottom up. And I'd say that's what America's greatness was that the middle class, as a general sort of rule, could take its labor, you know, its ideas and so on, and turn it into capital. And that's basically what the two Steves did with Apple. They took their ideas, their human capital, their social capital. Wozniak sold his calculator for $120 or something. In other words, they took their ideas and their labor, right? There was Steve Jobs, you know, soldering circuit boards and stuff in the garage, and then they turned it into capital. And then that's what's lacking now is the middle class has very few opportunities to turn their labor into capital. Instead, they take their labor, they pay their taxes, and they pay their debts. And then it's like they have nothing left. And the opportunities
are... But do you think that's really true? I feel like there are still middle class people that can like forge their way out. But yes, we do get trapped into credit cycles and like mortgages or like we're beholden to the banks or whatever. But I do feel like the opportunity is still there. Do you feel like it's gone?
No, I think there's definitely opportunities, but I think it's I think it does require, and maybe it's always required, a bit of unconventionality. And I'll give you a quick example. A lot of young people are building micro homes, right? And the idea is, hey, you know, I don't want a $300,000 mortgage. And it's all like, excellent, this is a solution. Yeah. Right. You build a house with whatever cash you have and then you're debt free. And then your labor is now yours to benefit from.
All right. So how much of that? All right. Since we're talking about labor, you can tell I'm going way off script here. Right. How much of that labor? I mean, that was Marx's whole thing, was the labor theory of value. How much has that changed when you like add in social media, for example? Like, people are making money without doing anything.
That's an excellent point. And I'm not a real fan of that aspect of Marx's thought.
You and I are both old guys.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's an excellent point. And part of one of my concerns is that when I look at the young generation, like the sort of Robin Hood click, then the focus is not on producing something that's going to be of value to the common good or increase productivity of the nation or anything. It's just like speculating to get as rich as possible in the fastest possible time.
I think the phrase is rich AF.
Yeah. And so then I think the question is, what's the incentive structure that we've created, either by happenstance or by policy?
Goes away. I believe it goes away. Like, I am trying to raise three kids and they look at what I do and they're like, why would I do that? It makes it difficult. And then I go, okay, if you don't want to do this, what are you going to do? And they're like, I don't know. And then they show me TikTok videos.
Right. Exactly. So I realize there's that generational thing, but then there's also a lot of young people who are interested in being productive in their own communities, right? And there's a lot of.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that are interested in like engineering and like building new things and stuff like that. I see that too, but I just wonder how they're going to get through it if we go into a financial crisis.
Yeah.
Well, like, what are they going to do?
I guess we can, if we want to look at the positives, I think one of the positives is this whole move to decentralize and relocalize, right? Because if you're going to use local capital, for instance, then you're less exposed to the, you know, vagaries of the global financial system, right? If you have a local marketplace, you're less exposed to the, you know, disturbances in the global supply chain. And it's better for the communities, like especially in things like food and, you know, fresh water and energy. If you can start developing those resources locally, then I think that's a potential job source. And it's also, resilience and just beneficial in so many ways. It's kind of a synergy.
Do you feel like you're experiencing that in Hawaii? I mean, it's probably a unique situation because you got to rely on boats and stuff.
Well, I think I'm really happy you asked that question because in a way it's that sort of Earth Island thing, right? You take an island chain and you can kind of say, well, this is interesting because we're kind of running a lab experiment.
Right.
Two generations ago, Hawaii still raised most of its own food. And there was a tourist industry. I remember distinctly in 1969, which was 50 some years ago, that everyone was thrilled because 1 million tourists arrived in the island chain in that time. And the most recent 2019 data was 10 million. And so there's been this concentration of economic power, if you will, that it's now only in tourism. And it used to be much more diversified. In other words, there was pineapple and sugar cane, which were large corporate plantations. And in fact, I did work on the plantation in that summer, like everybody else in high school. But there was a diversified, there was dairies, there were truck farms and so on. And so that all got too expensive, right? Because as land values rose and taxation and so on, it's become just headwinds to starting a small business in Hawaii. But that's starting to reverse. Now people are saying, do we really want to depend on 10 million tourists a year when it's just too many people?
During a pandemic, you can't do that.
But even beyond that, it's like, well, is that really where we want to go with this concentration of political and economic power? Or do we want to diversify our economy? And I think, like a lot of other places, I think there's a movement to diversify the economy. And so energy-wise, of course, we have wind and we have sun. So there's wind and solar. And we have geothermal here on the Big Island. And so I think that there's some, and people are trying to say, hey, the state's got to help small agriculture instead of basically burdening it, with regulations that only are supportable by large agribusiness and that kind of thing. So I think that's a positive thing. And of course, that's a job creator, relocalizing.
Yeah. I just wonder what the headwinds are like for that, because especially in Hawaii, they've always been controlled by corporate interests, right? Like corporate agricultural things. So how do you make that happen?
Yeah. Well, again, policy-wise, the state owns a lot of land, as most states do. And so they could, in fact, lease land at low rates to small farmers. Ranchers and so on. So there's some policy movement there, and people find a way if they're given.
Well, if they don't find a way, then what happens?
Well, then we're exposed to your topic of risk. The more we're dependent on long supply chains and a handful of nodes, whether it's slaughterhouses or internet nodes, then we're really vulnerable to fragile systems breaking. Yeah. Right, that's just systems dynamics. So
yeah, it kind of worries me post pandemic because there's a lot of stuff that's going to have to be reinvented.
Yes, but that's the opportunity, right?
Yeah, it's also I guess flip side.
Yeah, well,
I just always look at the dark side.
No. I'm often accused of doom and gloom, but I think like it's kind of like, isn't it just like, hey, look, we have to be realistic and look at the problem squarely. Or we're not going to have solutions, right? If we're going to kind of like tiptoe around it and suppress it and not look at it squarely, then how are we going to solve the problem? So
yeah,
I think doom and gloom is the first step. Like, be realistic.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would probably agree with that because, that's what we do.
Yeah.
But I do worry that like politicians and stuff like that, like people in other businesses than ours, they don't go to the next step, which is what is the solution. Politicians thrive on gloom and doom, right? Yeah. That's aware to me every time I freaking open the news. Like, what the hell? Delta variant? What about the Lambda?
Right. Yeah. Well, isn't part of what you and I see, I think, as solutions is for people to try to pull away from being completely dependent on these power nodes, whether it's the government or the the global marketplace or the financial markets. I mean, if, you know, in other words, if you can reduce your dependency on these, then you're already in better shape, right?
Yeah. And, well, and that's so, what I was liked about your writing is that you're advocating like an Emersonian rugged individualism. Like, let's not worry about that stuff and take care of ourselves. And if we can figure out a network that we help each other, that's a good thing.
Right.
You know, and Emerson was talking about that in what, the 1830s, I think. So,
yeah.
And I think the only thing, all right, so maybe I'll ask this question just because I'm curious. Emerson was a minister and he used the ministry and like sermons to like convince people of things. And we don't do that. Like we just write and we publish stuff online and then we use the marketplace instead. Because we try to, like, if we say something and people buy it, then we're like, hey, that worked. Let's do that again. So it's very different than setting up a church and, like, understanding people's relationship with God, which Emerson talks about a lot, right? So I don't know what your view is on that. Do you think there's a venue there where you can talk to people about their faith and that kind of thing? Because my faith has always been the market.
You raise a really interesting topic. And just kind of to use your example of Emerson in the early 1800s, there was a Great Awakening, right? The 1820s.
I did an old project on the Great Awakening when I was
Excellent. Okay, well, good. You can tell me more about it. But there was the first Great Awakening was in the 1700s, and this was the second. And so
1830s, and I'll tell you what happened.
Okay.
Then he wrote the story of New England and the Puritans. And I grew up in New Hampshire believing that. So when I found it out, I was like, what? Like when I actually read it, I was like, my entire life.
No. And so, well, you know, there's been a lot of people that have written about the inner kind of the synergy of Protestant work ethic and capitalism and so on. And this is not to say that Catholicism doesn't have a role in that. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting academic ideas about is faith part of why of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And I think, as a multi-faith society now, I think we can kind of maybe separate out the faithful in whatever faith they hold. They're much more similar to each other than to, you know, people who have no religious or faith connection or belief system. But I do worry about the morality decline in America. And I call it publicly, it's a moral cesspool. And I say that in things like student loans, like when you and I started out, or in, at least for me, two generations ago, the idea that it was acceptable or even something to applaud that we're going to load young students with no income and no wealth with $2 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been criminal. That would not have been acceptable. And no matter how much you lobbied.
Right, I think I might be a little bit younger than you because yeah,
you
I
are.
Did that. I was like, oh, yeah, I get it. I'll do this. And it got me through school. And then suddenly I was in debt and I was like, holy shit. And I think that's literally the reason that I have been writing the stuff I've been writing for 25 years, 30 years, because I was like, what just happened?
Yeah, but you get my drift it's like what was acceptable has changed. And so, for instance, that it used to be unacceptable for pharmaceutical companies to advertise directly to consumers. That was against the law. Now it's not only acceptable, it's everywhere, you know?
And it's pandemic.
Yeah, even before the pandemic. So I think
What I mean is the widespread sales of pharmaceuticals is pandemic.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's what
I'm saying.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a little bit personal to me because one of our neighbor's sons died of opioids.
Tragic.
Kind of like we grew up with them and he's not here anymore.
Yeah, that is extremely tragic. And it's unfortunately widespread.
Yeah.
I think your question about faith is interesting because can we look ahead to a future where there's a commonality, in other words, of values, whether you believe in God or not? Is there a, reach that?
I don't know. That's why I was bringing it up, because I didn't know what your opinion was, but that guided generations of people.
Right.
But it doesn't any longer. I mean, there are a lot of people that like have faith in things. And I, you know, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking about like when you and I are talking and then people like tap into this and they hear what we're saying, we're not ministers. We're not professing faith or whatever. Like, and we're talking about markets. That's been my guiding sort of mission is I just believe that people can engage in transactions out of goodwill. Like I can sell you something, you'll buy it, or you can sell me something and I'll buy it. And the money has to have some value in between. There's no faith in that other than that we believe in the money.
Well, let's take a look at that. I mean, that's certainly true at one level, but we also have to have trust in each other that whatever I bought or we sold lives up to whatever the sales pitch
price.
Was.
Yeah. Let's just call it the price.
And then Adam Smith, he's famous for like the invisible hand, which is basically if we all follow our self-interest, everything will work out great. But he also wrote about the moral foundation of the society.
That's my literally one of my all-time favorites is the theory of moral sentiment.
Yeah. And that's isn't that what we're talking about?
The idea that you actually have to trust in the person you're talking to.
Right, right.
That's amazing. That's a like amazing idea in moral philosophy.
It is. And then if we look at like stagnant economies, I mean, we discover that trust is in other and strangers is very low.
Yeah.
And that inhibits. But don't you think we're also talking about the fact that maybe America's lost its moral moorings?
Yeah, I don't want to go there, though. That's why I was asking you the question is like, I just don't want to go there because I don't believe it.
Okay.
I don't believe that people are, I think that people are morally good. And I do think that they get misguided. And we've seen a lot of that. So there's evidence that we get misguided all the time. Come on, man. I live in Baltimore. Every day, it's like, how many people got killed last night? So I do believe that we get misguided, but I don't think like human beings are fundamentally bankrupt.
No, I agree with you. Individually, everybody's trying to be a good person and be ethical, but the system itself, I think, is corrupted.
Yeah, how do you fix the system? That's what I want to say. And you know what? I've been a kind of a hardcore conventional constitutionalist for a long time, because I think that was the best effort we've ever made. And they're kind of fucking it up right now. But I still think it's the best system we've ever even conceived of.
Well, let's go back to the early 1900s where Teddy Roosevelt saw the systemic threat of monopolies. And so then he pursued antitrust, right? And those were the first antitrust legislation. And I think that's kind of, I see it as one of the corrective mechanisms that proved the system, the Constitution did work. But it required an activist leader to come in and say, hey, look, these monopolies are a threat, to our economy and society. And so they need to be limited. You know, it's not that we need to destroy Standard Oil, but we have to put some sort of limits on the concentration of wealth and power. And I think if we wanted to say, what's your idea to fix this? I'd say, well, we need to have that again. In other words, we need to be able to put reasonable limits on the concentration of wealth and power. And that doesn't seem to be that difficult to get consensus on. And we have to make sure that monopolies and cartels have to face competition, because competition is the only thing that enables adaptability and flexibility and innovation, right? Because if once somebody locks a market down and they buy up their competitors and there's no competition, well, then you get stultification. And I'm afraid that's what's one of the core problems.
Well, I would just extend your comments to social media.
Yes.
Because now, like I've never been in favor, even in history class, I've never been in favor of the like the way that they trust busted and all that kind of stuff. I've never been in favor of that. But right now, we need a trust buster for social media. We need somebody to let us talk.
Yeah. And I know this.
We could get shut down for having this conversation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And in fact, you say, you can't say that.
Yeah, precisely.
And to them, I just want to say, you go away.
I
could say it in like more colorful language, but.
My term is privatized totalitarianism, because it's like, where's democracy when somebody can shut everybody down, on their own, on their own accord?
It's not going to work.
No. So,
historically it's called fascism.
Right. Right. Well, there we go. We're going to be shadow banned. But, Addison, I know this is part of why I get accused of being, a Marxist. Is I've proposed on my blog, hey, we need to turn these into utilities. In other words, they have to be really regulated.
I'm not in favor of that, but I can see the argument for sure.
Yeah.
What we did with electricity and
and water. In other words, if it's an essential, then the people have to have a say.
The only thing that's remaining is somebody has to make the argument that it's essential. And we haven't done that yet. But then you take, literally, the guys that are trying to go to freaking Mars off the market. is that a good thing?
Well, I would say in terms of I think social media and the internet are essentials. And so they should be regulated like a utility. And that way the public has some say.
There yet. You're going to have to convince me.
Okay. Well, it's good that we have a disagreement over how to control social media. If somebody else comes up with a better solution. West
and somebody's going to come in with a gun and figure it out. That's going to happen.
Yikes.
I mean, that's how everything gets civilized. All right, man. It's good to see you. I think we've probably gone way over our time. Thank you, Charles, for joining me.
Thank you.
I will talk to you again soon.
Quick, before you go, be sure to check out Charles' blog, Of Two Minds, and follow his essays in our own Daily Reckoning. I hope you enjoyed it. See you at the next jam.